the very beginning was trying to find something inside myself to say, why am I going to go call on this farmer? Why do I drive down this driveway? And it migrated quickly away from me thinking that I was selling things for the crop to really finding answers for the farmer, because the acre doesn't buy anything. As cool it is to talk about the science, it's actually the human side of the business that creates change, convincing the farmer to select the right hybrid at the beginning of the process, and then feeding that crop the right way, and then advancing with all of the herbicides, insecticides, fungicides that are a lot of fun to talk about, but make sure that the crop is optimizing what that ground can give it against the budget of the farmer. So I think that's where my career probably took a turn, is realizing it had less to do about the science. That was the second thing. The first thing was solving the person's needs. And that became kind of, I think, a foundation for leadership for me.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. A robust return on your sorghum investment is not just a dream. Learn more at doubleteamsorghum.com. KWS Hybrid Rye, seeding the future since 1856.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Today is my first episode as host, so please excuse any mistakes that get made. Today we're going to be welcoming to the show Gary Halverson from CHS. Gary is an executive vice president. He's been with CHS for over 30 years, starting his career calling on farmers as an agronomist. Prior to his current role, he led the wholesale and resale agronomy teams for CHS. Welcome, Gary. How are you?
Oh, good. I'm good. Thanks, Mark.
So I'm going to start out by asking you just to expand on your path, in your career that has gotten you to the point where you're at today.
That's a long journey. I started my career after college calling on farmers out of a retail business. Back then, we were called crop production specialists, not agronomists. That kind of changed with crop sciences, kind of a migration, I think, in academia. And then from there, quickly worked into management, led some businesses. I moved here in 2014 to our corporate office in Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, and took over the retail arm and the agronomy businesses associated with that. And then in 2018, I took over our wholesale crop nutrients business, 2019, our wholesale crop protection business. So I had the whole agronomy platform. And then we went through a rebirth as a company, and I was asked to lead all of our sales teams. So today, my role is all the go-to-market teams for the company, whether they sell our energy product lines, sell grain to our customers around the world, sell agronomy products in the United States, and Canada. And so that's my occupation, is the sales side of the business. But I started my career as an agronomist. So perhaps today I'm a recovering agronomist of sorts.
aren't we all, as we get into the career further and further? So let's maybe jump back. And, you said you started your career, calling on farmers as an agronomist. Mm-hmm. What were the key moments, in that time frame, that got you moving down this path into leadership roles?
Well, yeah, I didn't start out with this aspiration. This is by good grace of some other design, I think. But for me, it always started with making sure I was doing the right thing for the farmer. The very beginning was trying to find something inside myself to say, why am I going to go call on this farmer? Why do I drive down this driveway? And it migrated quickly away from me thinking that I was selling things for the crop to really finding answers for the farmer, because the acre doesn't buy anything. As cool it is to talk about the science, it's actually the human side of the business that creates change, convincing the farmer to select the right hybrid at the beginning of the process, and then feeding that crop the right way, and then advancing with all of the herbicides, insecticides, fungicides that are a lot of fun to talk about, but make sure that the crop is optimizing what that ground can give it against the budget of the farmer. So I think that's where my career probably took a turn, is realizing it had less to do about the science. That was the second thing. The first thing was solving the person's needs. And that became kind of, I think, a foundation for leadership for me.
Ah, very good. So with over 30 years in the ag industry, how have career opportunities evolved for these young, brilliant minds that are entering that agronomy field today?
Yeah. So I, you know, the easiest place to start your career is closest to home, because it's the place where, whether you're from an ag background or not, but it's where culturally you assimilate the quickest. And that was the case for me. I grew up in North Dakota and started my career in North Dakota. But really where good personal growth happens is when you take a bold step away from the things that aren't as known for you, other cropping systems, other cultures, other geographies, et cetera. That's where you can really add fuel to a career and accelerate someone's growth. And I think, you know, young people are showing up more ready to work today than probably I was on the technical fronts. I think that's the place where they have the strongest aptitude. Where we need to press in and work is on those interpersonal skills to make sure that they're ready to have, you know, a new relationship and really, really work that side of them as a person. Because again, they show up intelligent, obviously educated, articulated to work, just making sure that they round themselves out. And it's that challenge to grow that really young people can be benefited by.
Yeah, I my son is just entering into an undergraduate degree in agronomy. Fortunately for me, it's here at Iowa State, so he's stayed close to home. You know, and he's grew up, you know, watching his, you know, grandfather farm, you know, when he was really little, and now seeing his uncle's farm a little bit, right? And then he sees me from the research aspects of it. And so we often talk about, you know, what is it that you need to do, you know, to be able to excel, you know, in academics, you know, quite honestly, as a freshman. But I anticipate this is going to change as he hopefully rapidly learns and knows more than I do. Right. So, you know, we do talk quite a bit about these things. And so I think those interpersonal skills that you mentioned are really quite key. And I do look forward to watching how he develops around those. Are there other skills or traits, you know, that you think are most critical for these students, you know, as they start going out, you know, maybe initially as interns, but, you know, eventually they're going to be entering the job market too?
Yeah, I think, you know, for us as employers, we look for a lot of attitude traits and a lot of the interpersonal things, because if they have gaps in either their internships that don't round them out quite as much as you know, we might have liked, we'll just on the job train them and just accept that. And it depends on what role. I mean, here at our company, we've got, I don't know, numerous masters and PhD scientists that work around greenhouses and labs with reverse engineering our competitor products or as a chemistry or helping engineer and help tweak the in-field aspects of new products. So there's that section of agronomy. Then we've got those farmer-facing folks that are, you know, trying to help fill out crop plans and help advance yield for the farm. And then we've got another segment of people that graduate with degrees that are just purely salespeople and work in the B2B space. And we generally onboard those folks early in kind of a support role before they're ready to take on a full-blown sales territory. But, you know, there's a lot of different angles for people to go. And sometimes we push them based on perhaps internships or their own natural gifts and push them down a particular track so they fit in. So there's no one thing that people are missing. It's too big a fairway to hit. But there's a lot of different avenues inside agronomy where you can graduate with a degree in crop sciences and add value for companies, for us or companies like us.
So I wonder too, precision technologies, you know, analytics, all of this has come into agronomy more so now than it ever has been, right? Are these traits that you're looking for, or these skills that you're looking for out of these new graduates?
Yeah, we definitely want to see kids with some kind of technology in their roadmap that they've accepted in school and perhaps taken on as a challenge in internships, because we know one thing for sure, that this isn't a phone, right? This is a portal to all kinds of information and technology. And as AI becomes more invasive and more a part of what we do in field on farm, the ability to utilize the right technology at the right time only helps accelerate, you know, the entirety of crop sciences. And that's an exciting next step for us. And I think, you know, young people today come come to this differently. I'll use the phone as an example again. For me, this was novel. For kids and my kids, your kids, it's native. For them, they grew up with it, right? And that those are big distinctions. But I think that for young people to be successful entering the workforce, having some kind of precision understanding as one of the building blocks for their career is really, really important. Because as I said at the beginning, it's just going to be more and more part of how we operate, being able to communicate the complexity and make it simple. So the interpersonal skills and then having a foundation of tech in your background is, I think, the most important pieces of the puzzle.
So you brought up AI real briefly, and maybe I shouldn't ask this question, but I'm going to. How is AI transforming the agronomy business as well?
So today I tell you that there's a lot of good ideas, and we don't have a product in our hands that scales and matches our other systems, because everybody had invested on the first wave of tech in ag, precision planting, precision application of fertilizer, variable rate zone maps, all those things were happening. And so we've got technology that supports those applications on farm, in field, and with hybrids and varieties. And then we need this intersection of the AI that comes to that the right way. So a lot of good ideas. You've got companies like Taranis that I think are pushing to the forefront, a virtual agronomist, they're calling their tool. But those aren't integrated into, you know, kind of the systems of ag yet. And that's coming. That's around the corner. And it's funny, I was just recently doing some research about that. And on average, workers are finding productivity increases with AI in their hands as a tool. It doesn't replace the person. It only augments the person. But those production increases on average across industry are something like 17% more productive. And so it's another way for us to take this and add fuel to those relationships and help advance, you know, the average on every farm and getting the most out of what the field and the farm's capable of doing.
Yeah. AI is one of these new technologies, right? That at the university here, we're quite honestly, we're trying to understand how to best use it as well. And we do have a few of our teaching faculty that are really, you know, trying to bring this into the classroom a little bit. And one of the things that we've had conversations around 20 years ago or 20 plus, you know, years ago when I was an undergrad, you know, a lot of times, we were using Google for the first time, like learning and pulling out information. Right. And at that time it was, you have to check your sources, right? You need to be using primary literature and making sure you have good sources, you know, from this vast information coming from the internet. And now what they're saying is, yes, AI can tell you all these things. It can generate all these things. But now you have to go back and check that the sources that they're using are correct.
That's right.
So, it's been quite interesting to kind of watch this come along and kind of draw some parallels, you know, over, you know, two decades, you know, difference in what's happening here.
We have some practical places here at CHS that we use AI. Like we're able to, we call it scrape, but source fuel pricing information from 3,200 different terminals around the United States. And the AI grabs that quicker than people could ever do it, and then builds these complex models into simple decision points that we can go back and then build our price models off of. So it just accelerates the pace at which information is available and it cleans it up for us. But that's a very narrow place that as you said, we built trust because it's our AI. It's the way we built it. Now we trust it. Now, how do we do that when it's open source, when it's all the different data that can perhaps accelerate, but also create complexity because of inaccuracy? And that's the reason I think on the crop sciences side, we're a little bit more patient to make sure that the information is right. Because if a farmer gets 40 chances to plant that crop, that's 40 recommendations that we get to make from industry to farm, trying to place the right hybrid and variety, trying to make sure we've got the right products and kind. We can't miss. And so that's the reason I think that we're being probably good stewards of all of that, Mark, to make sure we do it right.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's really going to be the key with this is making sure that we understand how it's working and finding the right places to launch this, right? Agriculture is a trust-based business, especially when you're on the customer-facing side of it, too, I suppose.
That's right. And I'd say even for our agronomists that are working on product development, it's trust. Because if we're going to put it in field on even large trials, you go from plots to large trials to full-scale deployment or going to full market, everybody has to have trust that the first person had the best intent and had done the work using good science at the beginning of that value chain before we ever get to the end. So, and there's a lot of personal reputation and company reputation that goes along with that.
So the agricultural economy is in a very tough place right now, as you're well aware, I'm sure, right? Again, having a son moving through the pipeline, right? I sit back and I look at this and we talk a little bit about various things, but one of the things we're talking about is where does he want to put his focus? And he's struggling in some degrees, you know, with this, whether he wants to be on the seed side or the agronomy side or the, you know, chemical or soils, right? And I think part of the consternation that he has is just where the ag economy is right now. And it's a little bit discouraging in some respects. And I know just talking to some of his friends that are a couple of years further along, you know, they sit back and say, "Ooh, I don't know how this is going to work." I guess maybe where I'm going with this is, you know, what's some advice that you would give some of these students, you know, in helping them, you know, continue their education, but then also move into some early career positions?
Well, the first thing I'd say to answer this, because these are all really good points, that ag isn't in a glorious place in this moment. First thing I'd say is, do you see noble work inside crop sciences, inside all of these different places, these vocations that you outline, Mark? And the answer to that is yes, that we're creating the crop that creates the calories that either feeds, you know, mammals for human consumption or feeds humans directly. Like, this is noble work. These are calories that we create. That's human value. So that goes beyond just a moment in time and a first job or a paycheck. This is big, big stuff. The second thing I'd say to that, because we built that foundation, is ag has always gone through cycles. My career started in the mid-90s, and people were running from ag because there was no future. Farmers were struggling to stay on farm. There was something called LDP payments, loan deficiency payments, a government program built inside that version of the farm bill. So there's been these macro factors that have impacted ag for generations, really, because there was a boom after World War II, and then it crashed. And then the 60s were hard with dairy farms, and they collapsed. Crop farming blew up great in the 70s, and the 80s were hard. So this is the way ag works. But there's a certain resiliency to those of us that have been in this a long time, recognizing that the bottom of the cycle might be 3 years and the top of the cycle might be 3 years. But one thing's for sure, it will happen. And there'll be good days again in the future. And the unfortunate part about it, the thing that corrects the market and market prices that are today a burden for our farmers, the thing that corrects it is somebody else having trouble somewhere around the world. We just hope it's not in our backyard, but that's the unfortunate truth, that we have to use what we learn in economics, that supply and demand works. We need to today lower global supplies and increase demand, and the prices will rally. And that's the cycle of this. But really, the foundations are still strong, because on-farm balance sheets are generally okay. Most farms prepared for this. Agribusinesses are prepared for this because we've had a few good years here recently. And so I think all in all, ag's in a fine place. There's going to be no end to places for young people to find valuable careers, whether they choose, you know, crop nutrients, soils, crop health through any number of paths. So there's going to be lots of opportunity for young folks.
Yeah, I think you're hitting it right on the head. Is kind of watch those cycles, and you do notice that they come around, right? One thing that I've been thinking a lot about is that this cycle is a little bit different than maybe we've seen, you know, from the past. And part of that is, we've had some really good production years, and so the supply and demand is a little out of whack. But I think that right now we have some geopolitical things that are occurring that are just a little bit different, right? And so recognizing that and those things aren't going to happen all the time either.
But, you know, geopolitics has been a part of this system for forever. I mean, I can go to the Ukraine conflict with Russia, and that in and of itself didn't impact S&Ds, but it did impact the trade flows. Because then Russian wheat doesn't get to the normal markets. It had to find a way And so you saw that, you know, in the nearby, there was a war premium put on wheat. And then slowly, as the Russian wheat finds a way to get to markets like India or their trade partners in Iran, that once that comes to market, then the markets rationalize again. So there's always been this idea that geopolitics can move price. Today, what's different is the trade negotiations that are ongoing based on DC politics here. The U.S. is the genesis of it, as opposed to in the past where we've been the recipient of those outside factors. And so that is a demarcation, right? Perhaps a distinction without a difference, but it does feel different because the weight is happening U.S. out. But, you know, we're hopeful that there is good trade deals to be struck and that the American farmer and agribusiness is a part of the solution for these trade deficits, and that our goods that we're manufacturing, whether it's Iowa corn and hogs or wheat from Montana, that we're a part of solving some of those trade disputes, and that there's new markets that are opened up that we can sell into. So you know, I think stay tuned. So the circumstances are definitely different, but the factors are always there in some way.
How does, I'll say global, I'll call it, it's the whole global supply and demand, right? And you know, 20 years ago, the U.S. was dominant in corn and soybean production. That's not the case now, right? We have some large competitors coming at us from the soybean production perspective, most notably, but, you know, South America also, they grow a fair amount of corn. How does that play into your business and how you think of things?
Yeah. So for us, you know, at the beginning of my career, we would say proudly that the U.S. farmer was the most efficient and price competitive farmer on the planet. And today we'd say that that's normalized with the Brazilian farmer, that in some ways, based on the amount of available land and based on their cost of production, they do have perhaps an advantage over the U.S. farmer on soybeans, and they're becoming more competitive on corn. Now, the end of that story isn't written, but I can tell you this, that the U.S. farmer's grains are still needed, that today Brazil can't feed this world in an entirely independently, and so the U.S. farmer still has a substantial role to play. At the same time, I think, you know, you could build a case that the RFS needs to increase, renewable fuel standard, where more ethanol could be a benefit to the U.S. farmer in balancing production and demand, not just food, but fuel. And then, you know, lastly, I'd say we still have gains to make in U.S. agriculture. We've been pushing the trend line yield on corn up since post-World War II, and there's still room for that acre to still produce. And so we're going to continue to see more efficiencies. We're going to continue to see more technology. And again, the U.S. farmer still has a big, big role to play around the world.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, we're closing in on the end of our time here. And as we do that, that means it's time for kind of the final three questions. So a little bit easier questions, maybe. We'll see. So let's start with the first one. What is your go-to, I was going to say ag resource, but maybe, you know, if I look at it as your role now, what's your go-to resource, you know, as a leader in a company?
My go-to resource, I need to keep track of a lot of what's going on around the world. So I have Fox News, the BBC and CBC, which is British Broadcasting, Canadian Broadcasting. So that's where the big news comes from. I don't entirely trust all social media. That could go out to all your students. That make sure if you have one really solid opinion, you seek truth on the other side of that. And that's not about politics. It's about trying to provide balance so that we're continually lifelong learners, so we can become invested in and valuable for the companies and those we serve and walk alongside. I think that's an important takeaway, that no matter what your source is, that you find a competing opinion so that you're more well-rounded.
What resources outside of agriculture and leadership would you recommend to our listeners?
You know, about leadership, there's a lot of really good writing that comes out of the Harvard Business School. They do a lot of great case studies. They do a lot of really good work that help round out leaders. The University of Minnesota has some really good things. Iowa State's got some good things. There's a plethora of places to source information. The important thing that I think that any young person, just don't stop. the day that you walk out with that paper or the day you cross a line, like I'm done with that econ class, is not the last day you take up that topic. Just know that wherever you're at in your career, that those topics that you're learning today, those foundations are going to continue to be with you for the duration of your career. Our company talks about supply and demand all the time. And we talk about linear regression models, and we talk about all the things that your kids are having to figure out. They're a part of business, and they have to be. That's the reason you're learning and setting that foundation now.
I like that response, because as an extension professional, I'm always saying, hey, this is about lifelong learning, right? There's always new things coming around that we have to learn about, and we have to figure out how we're going to incorporate into our, you know, our farming operation, or, you know, for me into my research or extension programming, for you into, you know, the company, right?
That's so right.
That's important. And then the last question here is kind of in your opinion, what sets successful professionals above the rest? Is there a couple key traits or?
Well, I think the most successful people, the thing that they offer their employer, whether it's you, Mark, or me, is effort. Because as I tell my kids, you have to show up early and work hard. There's certain table stakes that have to happen for us to be good contributors, because the world's filled with smart people, talented people, people with certainly, you know, extensive education, but it's how we put the effort in. It's how we show up every day, being a good teammate and putting in as much effort as we can. That's how you're going to rise above. So it's no different than trying to push your GPA or trying to be, you know, a valuable member of a team or a club on campus. For young people to really join the workforce, they need to really put their whole selves into it. That these young men and women that are so talented and so bright and so capable show up eager to learn and working hard, because that's how you begin to rise. That's how you get noticed, for sure.
Gary, thank you for joining us today. This was a great conversation, a great first episode for me to start with.
But thanks, Mark. It's my pleasure.
So that concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Send us your feedback, because it's invaluable to us to improve these episodes. Until next time, this is Mark Licht from the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.